Today, April 10th, 2003, and we're continuing our public hearing on House Bill 5021, which is the budget bill for the Department of Higher Education. On our agenda today are the statewides, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 5021. And Mr. Bender from LFO has some information and announcements for us, so please go ahead, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can briefly just start with some announcements to tell the committee a little bit about your schedule that's coming up. This is the last day of presentation on the Department of Higher Education's budget by the agency. Today you'll be looking at the statewide public service programs. Then on Monday, you will be holding a public hearing on the Department of Higher Education budget to take public testimony. So that Monday will be a public testimony day. Then next Tuesday, for the remainder of that week and for the beginning of the following week, you have scheduled the community colleges budget. And then finally, there's one budget left after that. It's in the form of two bills, but you'll be working on the budget of the Department of Education. We looked at the state school fund bill already, but after community colleges, there remains the programs and administration of the Department of Education. That should take you through to May 2nd, at which time you're scheduled to have completed public hearings on all of the budget bills that have been assigned to the subcommittee. Today, as I mentioned, you're hearing a presentation on the statewide public service programs of the Department of Higher Education. I just wanted to very briefly, you're going to be getting, of course, information in the presentation as to what these programs are and what they do. I just wanted to point out a couple things about them, though, and that is that these programs, which are located at Oregon State University, are all financed or all approved by you as separate line item appropriations within the higher education budget bill, which is to say that the funds that you approve are not transferable by the department between among these three programs that you're hearing today, or between any of these programs and the general education and general budget. So these are separate line items. I have distributed to you just a brief description of these programs. Again, you'll be getting more descriptions in the presentation. But what I did was I just printed out the web pages, the introductory web pages for each of these three statewide public service programs, which will give you a very high overview of what they do. The amount of funding in these programs is significant. Combined, in the governor's budget, there's approximately $96 million of general fund and $245 million in all funds to operate the three statewide public services. They are not equal in size. You'll be hearing presentations in the order from the largest to the smallest. The agricultural experiment station in the budget, there's approximately $53 million of general fund. The extension service, the governor has a figure of approximately $37 million. And the forest research laboratory in the governor's budget, there's about $5.2
million. Thank you. Questions or comments for Mr. Bender? Chancellor Jarvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Good morning. My name, for the record, is Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. As Mr. Bender has indicated, today you'll be hearing from the three statewide public service agencies housed within the Oregon State University in its role as Oregon's land-grant institution. They are the Agricultural Experiment Station, Extension Service, and the Forest Research Lab. Each of them is budgeted separately, and each receives a separate state appropriation line and other funds limitation in the OUS budget bill. I want to stress that the Oregon University System, as you know, has three primary missions: instruction, research, and public service. And these entities, the statewide public services, contribute essentially and centrally to each and every one of those mission goals. Last week, you requested information on the origins of the statewide public service units, and we provided in your packets a two-page handout on the important dates in the chronology and the establishment and evolution of these units. The Agricultural Experiment Station has its origins in the 19th century when Congress in 1862 passed the Morrill Act and created the provision of land grant institutions. Our own Agricultural Experiment Station was established in 1868 at what was then the Oregon Agricultural College. Federal funding of the experiment stations was established in 1887. OSU Extension Service was established by the Oregon Legislature in 1911, and that preceded by 3 years the 1914 Smith-Lever Act, which created and funded the National Extension Service Program. And the Forest Research Lab had its origins in 1941 here in Oregon and formally became a separate budget entity in 1966. The purpose of my introduction is to affirm both personally as chancellor on behalf of the university system and on behalf of the state board the central and essential role played by the statewide public service programs in the mission of the university system. It's sometimes easy to think that because entities have a separate line item there and somehow separate from the rest of the system, and I'd like to dispel that notion. Although the land grant mission is formally assigned by law to Oregon State University, the elements of that mission are informally woven throughout the fabric of a comprehensive public university system. And what you're hearing today is as important to us and to the entire system as the rest of the presentations you've heard throughout this last week for us. Let me introduce now the first of the presenters for today, Dr. Thane Dutson, the Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences and Director of the Agricultural Experiment Station.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions or comments for Chancellor Jarvis? No, we're going to let you off the hook easily this morning. Dean Dutson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the time before this committee to talk a little bit about the programs of the statewides, and particularly for me, the Agricultural Experiment Station. As you heard, the Agricultural Experiment Station.
For the record, Dr. Dutson, could you identify yourself?
Yes, I'm sorry. For the record, I'm Thane Dutson. I'm Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University and also Director of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Station. Thanks. As you heard from Chancellor Jarvis, the Experiment Station is one of the oldest entities at Oregon State University, being established after the establishment of the Land Grant Act, and I guess I'm a little bit older than the other two directors of the other two agencies, so I guess maybe that's why we're first. I would like to give you the mission of the Agricultural Experiment Station, which is to conduct research in the agricultural, biological, social, and environmental sciences for the economic, social, and environmental benefit of the citizens of Oregon. Now, in order to show you some of the items that relate to how well we meet that mission, we have created a database called Oregon Invests. And Oregon Invests measures how well we benefit the economy, how well we benefit the environment, and how well we benefit the social system of the state. As you notice here in this database, we have the mission of the Agricultural Experiment Station. We can search this database geographically by economic reporting regions or by county. So we can look at the projects that have an effect on each of the counties of the state. We can also look at the economic regions of the state and find the different benefits for that region. We also conduct studies around the state to determine how Oregon citizens feel about spending tax dollars on the various areas that we work in. The last survey that we did, Oregonians, 81% of those surveyed in an overall Oregonian survey said that they would support allocation of tax dollars to environmentally sound control of pests. And you notice all of those items on this list are at least 66% in support of expending funds in these areas. So as we do these surveys, that keeps us focused on the different kinds of areas that we conduct research in. Now let me get directly to looking at the economic benefit. This program adds up the economic benefits of each of our projects. And if you'll notice that as of right now, this year, the economic direct economic benefit of projects in the Agricultural Experiment Station and also Agricultural Extension contribute over $220 million to the state's economy. And so the investment in these programs creates a direct economic return back to the state. Now, that's the direct economic benefit, not the multiplier effect of those dollars in the economy. So as those dollars go into the economy, they do create some additional benefit. And this database will allow us to look at various individual projects. Let me choose one project which is here primarily in the Willamette Valley, and that's selection and testing of berry crops in the North Willamette Valley. Although when we look at the abstract, which explains what that project is about, and we determine where that project has benefit in the state, you notice there are a number of counties, although the counties in the North Willamette Valley are the ones that have the greatest economic benefit. We can look at the number of cooperators who cooperate on this project, and you notice the U.S. Department of Agriculture has some researchers who are working on this project in addition to our researchers at the experiment station. We can also determine how this project is disseminated. Normally that's through the Extension Service and through our extension programs, but also through the classroom. And if we look at this project, we notice there are two direct courses that the research data from this project goes directly into the classroom. So it doesn't have to wait to get published in a book and then the book converted back into the classroom. We have researchers who are top researchers in the nation, and they're sitting in the classroom providing this newest research data to the students. We also, on this project, have three students working on that project. So students are employed on these research projects as well. Now we can also determine, in addition to the economic benefit, the social benefit, and you notice there is a little number over to the right of each of these items, the economic, social, and environmental. That rating goes from a -3 to +3. So this project has much greater economic benefit than it does environmental benefit, but does have a positive environmental benefit. And essentially, if you look at this, is if you look at the environmental benefits, it provides new cultivars that are more tolerant to pest pressures, and about 18,000 acres of fruit-producing land will have fewer chemicals applied to it, as well as creating that additional economic advantage. So just using this one project, it gives you an idea of the kind of work that we do in the agricultural experiment station. And if we go back to the summary of all of those projects, and you begin to click down through the projects, you can see the multiple different kinds of projects that we have, all the way from some of them focus almost purely on environmental restoration and management, some of them focus more on economic benefit. But it's that combination of benefiting the economy while protecting the environment and meeting the environmental regulations while trying to improve the economy is really the sustainability aspect of the mission of the Agricultural Experiment Station. Now, if you look at where we started our budget in July of 2001 and where we end our budget at the end of this biennium, you notice the different reductions that we have taken over that period of time, ending this biennium with about a $51 million budget in the Agricultural Experiment Station. And these slides are in the booklet, and so if you want to follow along in the booklet as well, the first slide was on page 10. The next slide is the proportion of the budget that's expended in each of our program areas, and that one is on page 14. If you notice, we have a number of different areas that we expend resources, field crops being 27%, horticultural crops 20%, natural resources 16%, animals 16%, food science and nutrition 10%, economic development, trade, and communities 11%. So we apportion our resources into our different departments in those different areas. Now, if you'll notice these slides on page 12 and 13 show the relationship of our budget. The state funds portion of our whole budget is 43%, post-measure 28%. Federal formula funds 5%, sales, services, and fees 8%, and grants, contracts, and gifts about 45%. That's primarily grants and contracts. Now, if you notice the amount of those grants and contracts, 78% of those come from federal government, 17% come from industry contributions directly, state and local government contracts 4%, and then there's a small other category which is some gifts. Now, this shows again the detail of the gifts, grants, and contracts, and our state budget being almost equal. So we bring in from grants and contracts more dollars than is expended out of the state funds. But then our federal formula funds another 5%. So about 57% of our budget is generated outside of state funds.
Dr. Dutson, can you talk to us about what kind of things are involved in sales, services, and fees?
Yes. Part of that is we have some service centers, our seed testing laboratory, which we test seed germination and seed quality for the seed industry. We have other testing laboratories where we do testing for people, that would fall in that category. When we conduct research, many times we'll do research on large plots like 20 or 30 or 40 acres. When we harvest that, we collect the data and then we sell the residual product. So on our cattle operations, when we're doing research on cattle genetics, we will have some cattle after we've done the testing on those that we sell those. So that's essentially that combination of some services, but it's primarily sales of product that comes off of our research projects.
Hey, is this an area where you're trying to increase your revenues at all?
Not on the sales, because our mission is to conduct research, and if we begin spending our time and effort farming and have our scientists do the farming, we essentially are not near as efficient as the agricultural industry, and they're even having a hard time making the bottom line meet by raising crops themselves. So that's an area that we looked at a number of years ago, and we felt that it was going to cost us probably more to raise those crops than we could get out of them. So we feel that selling product is probably not a good way for us to meet our mission. We need to be focusing on the research. Now, on the service fees, some of those, normally we just get the cost of doing that back. Now, we might be able to increase some of those fees, but there is a problem if we charge fees over and above and in competition with other private labs and private sources.
Thank you.
Now, with the governor's proposed budget, you'll notice that the governor's proposed budget, our state general funds, and our grants, gifts, grants, and contracts would be close to equal in amount. And we have not indicated that we would be increasing our grants because we have lost a number of FTE during this last biennium. And those faculty members are the ones that actually bring in that money. So fewer faculty members means that we will probably be bringing in fewer grants and contracts. Also, you were given a handout which gave you the percentage decrease from the governor's budget, this sheet. That essentially gives you what the amount of reduction would be below the governor's budget at a 2%, 4%, 6%, 8%, and 10% reduction. And we have estimated over in the right-hand column how many FTE that would create, a reduction in FTE that would create. Now, in addition to those faculty members, it would reduce the amount of support level for them, the amount of administrative support, amount of supplies and materials for those members as well. So essentially that's our estimate. It really depends on which specific faculty members and which specific programs are removed during that reduction. So I would be willing to answer any questions.
Timing is perfect. I'm wondering what the total FTE is of your department.
We're at, right now, we're at about 140 actual faculty, professorial faculty FTE. I don't have the exact number, but I think we're about 300 and 50 overall FTE, which includes classified staff, support personnel, research assistants.
Follow up.
So when I see these reductions in FTE, what I'm getting at is what is the total that we're taking that off of?
Right. The total that this would come off from would be that 140 FTE.
pull up again, Mr. Chair. As you lose that research FTE, would support staff also be reduced?
Yes. We've calculated that it would be about $200,000 per FTE. So it's all of the support staff, all of the other FTEs that are associated with that project. Now, that's an estimate.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could follow up on Senator Meserle's line of questioning, could you tell us where at the 2%, 4%, 6%, and on cut level, where those cuts would be taken so that we have a better idea of what specific programs would be impacted?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we haven't determined those specific places where we will take those cuts at this point in time. First of all, we need to work with our stakeholders, with people out around the state that these programs supply the benefit to. We also need to determine mechanisms by which we might maintain the best level of program delivery under those reductions, and a different amount of reduction would cause a different scenario relative to how we would deliver those programs. For example, we may have to coalesce some departments together under the higher level of cuts. Under the lower level of cuts, it may be just a program reduction within one of our departments.
And if I may follow up, Madam Chair, but again, to make sure that I'm clear, you would be looking at the loss of approximately $200,000 per FTE?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator, are you sure you don't want to follow up on this?
If you want to continue the program,
okay,
go ahead.
Okay. Dr. Dotson, do you have a process in place whereby you can gather the stakeholders together and discuss these issues?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have put together in a process. We worked on a process over the past almost 2 years trying to determine the mechanism by which we will make reductions in our programs. And we've created a list of metrics which we measure program productivity. We use those metrics and apply those metrics to the individual programs and compare programs with each other on these metrics. We also look at the relative economic advantage to the state of the program area that we deliver these programs to, the different categories of industries such as the nursery industry or the small fruits industry or the potato industry. We look at the economic advantage of our cooperation with that industry. We also look at the amount of dollars that the industry contributes. So these are the kind of metrics. We also, on the academic program side of the college, measure the number of students, the amount of student credit hours, the cost of doing this research per faculty member, the amount of grants and contracts that they bring in. So we go through that measurement internally, and then we have a stakeholders group that we have put together. We met with those here about 3 weeks ago and discussed this process. They felt that that was a good process, but still they would like to be involved in our determinations before the final determinations are made.
And when you say stakeholders, what you're specifically referring to are members of the different commodity-producing areas that your projects have an impact on?
Yes, and we also have a consumer representative on our stakeholder group. We also have some environmental groups represented on our stakeholders group as well.
Thank
so it's a broad-based group. We have about 60 or 70 members that we try to get together in that larger group, So it's a little bit difficult to get them all together and also manage a meeting so that we don't waste their time as well.
Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, looking at your budget in 01, 03, and 05, it appears from the way I'm seeing this that you took substantial cuts in 03, as we all have, somewhere in the neighborhood of less than 10% in general funds. And your budget from the governor's balance budget in general funds appears to be, from what I'm seeing here, the same as it is at the end of the 03 cuts. There's no further cuts for your department as far as general funds is concerned. Is that correct, Steve?
So I'm sorry, you're comparing the...
If I'm looking at this correctly, I may not be. And a $53 million 0103 estimate for your final budget, and then the governor's 0305 budget is $53 million also. Is that those figures correct, or am I reading it incorrectly?
He's trying to find page
362. It's under the tab.
I see.
Cultural Experiment Station. Are those figures correct?
I think if you look at the material that Dean Dutson was showing in his handout here.
Well, it seems to match.
Yeah, does that match?
It's $53,215,953 for the state general funds for the governor's budget.
Right. They were eventually down to, for this current biennium that's ending, they were eventually reduced to approximately $51 million. And the amount that is in the governor's proposed budget is $53 million, so it's a slight increase.
So they actually have a slight increase over where they ended up with their cuts from '03.
Yes.
So even the governor's balanced budget, they're going to be up a bit from the end of '03. Is that correct?
That would be correct.
Would you agree with that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that is correct. There's almost a $2 million increase from our ending balance of 03 to our, of the 01-03 biennium to the beginning balance in the governor's budget of the 03-05.
And Madam Chair, I'm actually leading to a question, believe it or not. I just want to make sure my data is right. In 01 to 03, you somehow managed other funds to have a substantial increase, $48 to $65 million, and then from $65 to $69 million in 01-03, and then it's kind of flat through 03-05. And I was wondering, if you managed to make that big of a jump through other funds, is the limit in general funds preventing you from making a jump like that again to bring more money into your budget, or are there programs that have been lost? I can't tell from the detail given here of why your other funds have flattened out after a substantial jump in 01-03. You somehow brought in more money to your program than other funds. I wonder what happened to make that jump, and can it be any chance of it being duplicated in 03-05 to backfill your budget? Is there any possibility of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's an excellent question. And there are two factors that contribute to that. One is the other limited funds, sales, services, fees, and indirect cost. Some of that is spending limitation, which if we don't bring in the sales, then we don't realize the funds. So if that goes up, and actually it did go up in limitation, so there is the only way that we could increase that and actually meet that limitation is create the sales. And we think that we're not going to create those additional sales. So we feel our actual expendable amount isn't going to be quite that high. Our federal formula funds are flat because we haven't gotten an increase. We've been working trying to get an increase in our federal formula funds. But unless the federal government and USDA increases that, we have no ability to increase that. The other one is gifts, grants, and contracts. We had an increase in gifts, grants, and contracts and have constantly. But during this biennium, we essentially have removed FTE through retirements, resignations. So we have less FTE now to bring in those grants and contracts. And so we think the best we will be able to do in that category is maintain level funding. Now, before, we were increasing during that period of time, during the last biennium, but as we made our cuts, we essentially think that we will be level in that category. So the gift grants and contracts category is where we have our biggest advantage and our biggest possibility for bringing in extra funds.
Hello?
Well, I would just ask you to look at that very carefully. I mean, you did some substantial work in 2001-03, and at times like this, we are looking for funds. And I would encourage you to look a little more closely. A lot of people are out there in the school system, other places are using grants heavily to backfill. They're finding the personnel to write those grants and bring those grants in. The other question I had would be concerning fees and contracts. Are these fees and contracts with the people you serve? How many of the people being served in the parts of the government are stepping up and trying to help out with huge fees and things of that nature? Do you charge fees for your services to certain agricultural groups, or do you have contracts to certain agricultural groups?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes, those fees come primarily from testing fees, laboratory testing, and that's a fairly small portion of that budget. Those fees come directly from the people we serve, like the seed testing laboratory. We test seeds for the seed industry, and they pay for that. We just did increase the fees on our seed services, but that's a small portion of that budget. Of that budget, most of that budget is in the sales category, and indirect costs, which is returned overhead on grants and contracts. So those are the two largest pieces. We are looking at additional revenue as much as we can. Our area of additional revenue would be grants and contracts, but we're also looking at private sources and private funding. The industry is in various places agreed to help support more. You notice 17% of our grants and contracts came from industry before. We're trying to increase that proportion by having them increase their fees. Right now it's pretty difficult because the agriculture industry is in really economic tough times right now, the last 3 or 4 years. In addition to that, we're looking at private gifts and donations and endowed professorships, and we actually measure the amount of professorship support, amounts of scholarship support that come from various segments into our different departments. So we're looking at cranking up our fundraising in the private fundraising area. So we essentially are going to be focusing on those three areas.
If I might ask a follow-up question, Dr. Dutson, and I think what I need to talk to my colleagues about here is that we still have the extension service in the Forest Research Lab to go over. But I think it would be good for you to talk to us about how some of the commodity groups have actually stepped forward with private grants and support into the research part of the budget.
Yes, we measure the amount of support that comes from the different segments of the industry, and we have some of the larger industries. The wheat industry contributes between $300,000 and $500,000 a year to our programs to support work that is related to the wheat industry. Such industries as the hazelnut industry, fairly small industry, still contributes both in private donations in the foundation, but also with their commodity commission and funding through the commodity commission. So we have a number of those different groups. During this past year, we have had some of the industries, the nursery industry and the tree fruit industry in particular, who have actually given us some interim funding to give us some bridge so that we won't have to remove those programs so drastically in the areas that we serve them. So we've had you know, $90,000 in one case and about $100,000 in another case. So there are some additional funds that have even come in this last biennium, but on a more constant basis, those commodity groups do contribute to their own benefit, and that's primarily the 17% of our grants and contracts budget that I was talking about earlier.
Representative March.
Very briefly, I just wanted to understand how the federal formula funds worked. Is that a matching funds? And then secondly, I think it's just just for your edification, the map in your book on page 5 doesn't match the map in the extension booklet, page 6. There looks like a little error there. Federal funds formula, how's that work?
Madam Chair, Representative March, the federal formula funds is calculated on a fairly complex formula. It's based on state population, based on dollar value of the agricultural industry in the state, number of acres. There are a number of factors that go into that. And that formula has been set for many, many, many years. And politically, at the national level, people haven't really, they've tried to take it on twice in my memory and backed away from it because it was politically such a hot potato. So I anticipate that formula will probably remain the same. And yes, it is matching funds, and we're required to match those funds that come in the one-to-one match. Yes.
We'll easily do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Mesley.
Madam Chair, just for clarification for me, the grants and the outside private money that comes in, does that all come through the Ag Research Foundation?
Chair Morgan, Senator Mesley, the bulk of the commodity grants go through the Ag Research Foundation, the bulk of them. There are occasionally some that will be direct contracted with us through the research office at the university, but by and large, they all go through the Ag Research Foundation. Now, there are private gifts that go through the OSU Foundation, and those endowment funds go through the OSU Foundation rather than the Ag Research Foundation.
If I could just make a comment, Madam Chair. I'm fortunate to serve on that foundation board, and Dr. Bates, I wanted to make this statement for your knowledge as well, that is a board that does have a staff, full-time staff, and they work continuously to bring in more and more funding for the experiment station, and it's an active group, been there for many, many years, and they just do a good job so that these people can do the research, and the foundation is actively looking for funds continuously.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions or comments, final questions or comments for Dr. Dutson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair calls Dean Hoglum. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Lila Hoglum, the Dean and Director of Oregon State University's Extension Service, and I'd like to thank you for taking the time to learn a little more about the Extension Service this morning and what we do for the state of Oregon. You should have in front of you two things that I will be referring to, this booklet, and I know it looks very similar to the other one or two that you have, but if you look at the title, the one that says Oregon State University Extension Service is the one that will be working with, and then you have an additional piece that looks like this. It's some PowerPoint slides that I'll be using toward the end of my presentation to talk a bit more about some budget impact information. What I'd like to do is just simply step you through some of the information in this booklet. And so if you start out at the very beginning, earlier you found out from Chancellor Jarvis that Extension was created in Oregon in 1911. That was 3 years prior to it being authorized on the federal level. The Extension Service was created in Oregon by the legislature because the legislature believed so strongly that the research and knowledge base of the university needed to get out to the people across the state who could use use the information that they actually created extension 3 years earlier than it was authorized at the federal level. The mission of the Extension Service is at the very beginning of your publication. We are essentially the non-formal or non-credit arm of Oregon State University, and so we take the research and knowledge base of the university through non-formal or non-credit courses and take that out to the people across the state of Oregon. We do that through our county extension offices. We do have offices at this point in time in each one of Oregon's 36 counties. On page 3, you'll see some of the values that are important to the Extension Service. The issue of credible information and having the information that we provide being research-based is very important to us. And we work hard to try to maintain that. We also work very hard to be responsive to local people and to the needs of local people. One of the things that is important and both important and unique about Extension is that we operate based on the needs of local people, and so you can get to know the Extension program in one county in the state and go to another county and see some things that are very different. And that's okay, because the issues that we're dealing with are those issues that are most important to the people in that particular county. We also strive for excellence. We work very hard to make effective use of our resources. We do that through partnering with a number of public and private organizations, agencies, and other governments, county and state governments. We also use those funds to leverage through volunteers. We have about 30,000 volunteers who work on behalf of Extension to help us deliver educational programs to the people of Oregon. In addition, we work hard to provide extension programs to Oregon's increasingly diverse populations. If you look at page 4, you'll see the primary goal of the Extension Service is to build a sustainable Oregon, or to help build a sustainable Oregon. We do that in 4 ways. We do that by focusing on strengthening and diversifying local economies, by working to help build healthy families and children, by promoting environmental sustainability, and by working to develop community leadership across the state. Page 5 talks a bit about the character of the Extension Service. You will see the number of faculty, FTE, that we have there. One of the things that I want to point out to you so that you don't it doesn't become a concern is as you go through the FTE levels, and as I go through the FTE levels, you may see slightly different numbers. The reason for those different numbers is it depends upon when that particular page was printed, because the number of FTE that we had was changing throughout this biennium. But you can see that we do have about 348 faculty. That's about 242 at this point in time FTE. FTE is full-time equivalent. So we do have more faculty who have extension appointments who are part-time extension. That's because many of our faculty share appointments with the Agricultural Experiment Station or with the Forest Research Lab or with teaching appointments on campus. So we do have some people who are jointly appointed between various funding sources. I've already mentioned the volunteers that we incorporate into the program. Our volunteers contribute about 2 million hours annually on behalf of the people of Oregon, and so we believe that that's a very good payoff. I've also talked a bit about extension advisory committees and how our programs are determined locally. Extension programs are used by about 1 million Oregonians across the state annually as well. If you look at the map on page 6, and Representative March pointed out that the map in the Ag Experiment Station booklet and the map here is slightly different. Again, it's because they were printed at different times. But if you get them together, I can help you identify why the differences are in each of them. Basically, the bottom line is they're both the same. The detail within the map is slightly different. what this map shows is, again, that we do have an extension office in each one of the counties in Oregon. Some counties have more than one office. For example, Jefferson County, we have an office in Madras at the county seat. We also have an office on the Warm Springs Indian Reservation. So there are a few anomalies like that where we would have more than one extension office, but primarily we have one extension office in each of Oregon's 36 counties. The next page just simply identifies the Oregon Extension Service's major program areas. We do have five major program areas in which we work. One of those is agriculture. Another is family and community development. A third is the 4-H Youth Development Program. A fourth is the Extension Forestry Program. And a fifth is the Extension Sea Grant Program, which deals with ocean and coastal marine resource issues. The next several pages, and I'm not going to go through all of this material with you, but the next several pages simply has some examples of extension programs. This is not meant to be all-inclusive, but simply to give you an idea of some of the issues that extension is working in and the impact that we have had. What I will do is just simply point out a few of these to you. In our agriculture program, we work with a wide variety of audiences. Some of those that we've tried to focus on recently are some of the high-value crops, like the wine industry in Oregon, wine grape industry. The work that we've done there in the Extension Enology program has resulted in more than $1 million of direct economic benefit to Oregon's $33 million wine industry, just as an example. We have in the eastern part of the state a Treasure Valley Pest Alert Network. That network has saved over $2 million annually in crop value that might have been lost through pests as a result of that were saved as a result of this particular network. If you keep going through some of these, on the next page it talks a little bit about some of the things that we do in family and community development area. In probably one of our major emphases in this area has to do with teaching nutrition education to low-income and limited-income families. This is primarily an educational program that's focused in those areas of our state where we have high population, so inner-city audiences is what this particular program focuses primarily on, not exclusively, but primarily. This is a program in which for every dollar we invest in nutrition education, we can get a matching dollar from the federal government. Likewise, for every dollar that we cut out of this program, we lose $2 because we lose the match from the federal grant in this area. We have done some significant study of the impact of the nutrition education programs and have found that the studies have found that for every dollar that we invest in nutrition education, it saves $3.63 in future health care costs for Oregonians. So this is a significant program. It's also one in which we partner significantly with other organizations. We partner with the Oregon Food Bank. We partner with WIC and many other local agencies that work with low-income people. Our role, again, is to teach nutrition education. We don't give out food stamps. We don't deal with welfare payments. We teach nutrition education to families who are limited and low income in this particular area. If you keep going on page 10, it identifies some of what we do in the 4-H Youth Development Program. Yes,
thank you.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. Before you go on to page 10,
mm-hmm.
you skipped over the support for the micro enterprise development programs under
yes.
the community development.
Yes.
Could you give us the actual numbers of persons participating in the program? You've given us percentages, which are pretty impressive. 75% completing business plans, 25% starting new businesses. What are the actual numbers behind the percentages?
Senator Gordley, I don't have those numbers with me, but I am happy to get them for you so that you do have them. This is a program in particular. I know one of the counties that participated in this program was Polk County. It was conducted by a faculty member that was located there to work in Polk, Yamhill, and Marion counties. He was focusing particularly on underserved audiences and particularly on minority minority families who were coming into the county and helping them establish some kind of an additional economic base for them. And so that's, I know what the program is. I don't have the actual numbers off the top of my bed, off the top of my head, but I'm happy to get them for you.
That would be great. Thank
you. Okay, I will do that.
Please proceed.
If you look at page 10, then it talks a little bit about the 4-H Youth Development Program. We have around 79,000 young people involved in the 4-H Youth Development Program. One of the interesting characteristics about the 4-H program is it has changed significantly over the years. At this point in time, around 40% of the children involved in the 4-H program actually come from cities of 50,000 people or more. And so there are a significant number of urban children involved in the 4-H program. 64% of 4-H members today come from towns of 10,000 or more. And so it's just an interesting way that the 4-H program has changed as our population has changed over the years. One of the programs that I'd like to point out to you regarding the 4-H program is a program that we have that reaches out to Hispanic and Latino young people. It's called our Web Wizards program. It's a program that was started in Washington County in a partnership with Intel. This program focuses specifically on Latino youth who come into the county. It's to help teach them computer skills and to help them become, frankly, one of our major goals was to help them stay in school. And what we have found is that that program has been enormously successful. Of the young people who are involved in that program, 95% graduate. That is a comparison of 43% of the Hispanic children in this state who graduate. And so that program has been enormously successful. Of those 95% Latino youth who graduate, 98% of them are pursuing post-high school education in one form or another. And so that particular program has been, again, enormously successful. But there are many, many 4-H programs across the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Again, those are impressive numbers and obviously a wonderful program. But if we could, again, unpack the percentage
numbers
and get at the numbers.
I'd be happy to do that.
That would be very helpful.
Representative March.
Yes, thank you. You have nutrition for youth there, and it's also in family and community development.
Mm-hmm.
Do both programs get the federal match?
This particular program does not get the same federal match that the one that I talked about previously gets.
Thank you.
Yes. This is just a part of the program that is we've incorporated into 4-H.
Please proceed.
Okay. If you look at page 11, it talks a little bit about our Extension Forestry program, and you can see the nature of that program and the kinds of things that we're working in. The forest products industry in particular has created over the last year or two 1,400 new jobs in Oregon in that sector. We have worked a significant amount with those industries to help them be effective and efficient. You can also see some of the work that we do with the Swiss needlecast disease in order to help combat that disease and also in wildfire issues, land management to avoid the kind of wildfire that we had this last summer. So that'll give you an idea of some of the things that we work with there. Page 12 talks about the Extension Sea Grant Program. And again, this will give you an idea of some of the work that we do there. One that I'd like to point out to you is at the bottom of that page. This was a program where we worked with seafood processing plants in specifically in order to improve their efficiency, and those workshops, the plants participating, realized an annual savings of $1.1 million given the work that we did with those food processing plants. So this simply gives you an idea of some of the kinds of things that we are involved in across the state. If you look at page 14, it begins to get into some of our budget information. And I'd like to go through some of this with you. The information on page 14 is the legislatively approved budget as of July 1 of 01. So this is where we started out the biennium. This will simply give you an idea of the sources of our funds. In our legislatively approved budget, 63.26% of our funds, or at the beginning of the biennium, come from the state. About 15% come from the county. About 17.5% come from federal, and so on. So it gives you an idea of the funding that we receive and where those funds come from. The next page identifies essentially the spending patterns, if you will, in both state funding, that was available to us through the biennium, and you can see the reductions in state funds. The top line is the state funding that we were allocated at the beginning of the biennium, and you see the reductions that happened throughout the biennium. The second line identifies the other spending limitation funds that we have access to, and what you'll see is an increase in our the funding here. It's not an increase in funds. What we did was we had some fund balances in our federal account in particular that we began to spend in order to help us deal with the reductions that we were taking on state funds. And so those increases, in fact, there are two things here. There's an increase there. There was also an increase in this biennium in the limitation that we were provided for county funds. We did have an increase in county funds, and we needed to come back in order to get increase in spending limitation for those funds. So that's what's illustrated in the second line on that chart.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was looking through your budget here, and I could see that you obviously had increased your other funds, and it almost balanced yourself out by doing that. I was going to ask the question how you did it. Congratulations. I wish everybody could do this.
I wish I could continue it.
Yes. My next question is obviously that question.
Okay.
When I look over to 03-05, and my data is not as accurate as yours here because ballot number 28 is not in here and some other things, but it appears that you hope to increase your other funds in the 03-05 budget. And that basically the governor's budget is flat funded for you. You'll have about the same amount for the state.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to pick a difference up.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your plan for doing that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, congratulations. I'm glad you're going to do it, or going to try to do it at least. And I appreciate your efforts. But what's your plan?
Yes. Representative Bates and Chair Morgan, the numbers may in fact be a bit deceiving in that, yes, we are anticipating or are hoping that there may be an increase. We are hoping that, in fact, the county funds will continue to be strong. To be perfectly honest, that is a guess at best, because oftentimes counties fund us based on the amount of faculty, the number of faculty that we can have in the county. We use our state and federal general funds to fund faculty salaries, and those funds are going down. And so the number of faculty that we will have in counties will, in fact, be decreasing. What we have worked to do is we've tried to work with our county funding base to help them understand that it would be useful for them to continue to maintain and perhaps even increase funding at the county level in order to help us out. Whether we're going to be successful at that or not is very questionable at this point in time. Second thing that I'd like to point out is that the funds that we used during this biennium to help us budget balance the budget were fund balances, and so they're one-time funds. So the reality is we will need to take, for every dollar that we used of one-time funds to help us balance the budget in this year, in this biennium, that's going to be an additional real reduction in the next biennium because the funds simply will not be available again. We are also hoping that we will be able to increase the level of funding from grants and contracts. Again, I have to tell you, this is being very optimistic and very hopeful. Whether we truly will be able to do that with fewer faculty is questionable at best.
Thanks, Mullen.
follow-up. Before you have a follow-up, Representative Bates, let me welcome in the back a group of students that have come here today from Pleasant Hill to spend a day at the Capitol. And just to give you a little bit of information about what we're talking about, this is the budget of the Oregon State University Extension Service, and part of this budget funds the 4-H programs. And I would assume that coming from Pleasant Hill, there's a fair number of you that are in 4-H or have friends that are in 4-H, and that's what we're talking about right now. Representative Bates.
Thank you. I come from a community that is very interested in the issues you're dealing with, obviously. I believe we're losing an extension agent to the Dalles area as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that might affect county funding, I would guess, in my county, and affect your overall budget.
Yes.
And I'm not going to talk about that particular situation because it's complex and it's not appropriate here, but that's the kind of thing I believe you're talking about. As you downsize, you lose people from one county to another.
Mm-hmm.
And lose county funding, which follows the agent, I assume.
Yes.
Correct.
Well, it absolutely follows the faculty member. Yes.
Uh-huh. That would be reasonable. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you for your efforts. I hope you're successful.
We're going to work at it.
Please.
If you look then on page 16, what page 16 does is it identifies those positions that we have lost during this biennium as a result of the budget reductions. And Representative Bates, I don't know whether the position that you're talking about is in here. No, it isn't. As I look at this, it isn't.
It's just happening.
Yes, it's just happening. What you see here is a list of the faculty members that we have reduced during this biennium in order to address the budget reductions. And all this does is simply indicate where they're located around the state, and then a number of positions on campus as well. Right now, we have about 60% of our faculty who are located off campus in our county offices, and about 40% who are located on campus. And so those are the reductions that have been taken. If you look at page 17, you'll get more specific information about those positions. So the ones in the left-hand column are the off-campus positions. So you'll see there are a number of 4-H positions that have been reduced, a number in natural resources around crops, small farms, livestock, horticulture, watersheds, forestry, marine fisheries, and so on. And you'll see some of the family community development positions down toward the bottom. On the right-hand side of that column, you will then see the campus-based positions that have been eliminated during this biennium to help us balance the budget. We've taken additional funds out of support dollars, and there have been additional special project dollars and administrative funds that have been reduced in order to help us deal with the budget reductions during this current biennium. So this is simply an identification of where we currently are. If you look at page 18, you'll get a bit more information about the specific impact of those reductions. And so, for example, you'll see that we will have a reduction in potato disease management programs, a reduction in educational programs that support cereals like wheat and barley production and marketing, reduction in pesticide application management programs, and so on. And so you can see a reduction in some of the 4-H programs, reduction in our ability to deal with things like the Swiss needle cast disease and food safety with seafood processors and so on. So you just get an idea of some of the impact of some of the reductions so far. Page 19 simply lays out our total budget for this biennium after the failure of the measure on January 28th. So it gives you an idea of our whole funding base, both our limited funds and our non-limited funds. And so this is where the amount of grants and contracts that we have comes into play, just again so you can see the total budget. If you keep going, then page 20 identifies how we spend our funds. And so about 49% of our total funds go to the Extension Agriculture Program, about 21% to 4-H, and so on. You can see what the chart says there. Page 21 lays out our total funding at the governor's proposed budget level. And as you correctly identified, Representative Bates, there is, it's essentially level funding. It's actually a slight increase in actual dollars from where we are now. The real impact, however, is identified on the top of page 22, in that because of increased expenses, and by increased expenses I mean increases in salaries, increases in benefit packages, retirement packages like PERS and federal benefit packages, increases in health insurance and so on, the governor's budget is actually an actual 9% cut for us in real spending ability. So it's a cut from current service level for us. Now, there are a number of ways at which we can go about taking that reduction. And what I'd like to do is go to a couple of slides on the PowerPoint. And you do have copies of those slides on this handout, so you can follow along. If you go to the next one. This slide is the same as the page that we've already looked at in your booklet, which is page 16, which this is the way that we took the reductions during this biennium. If we go to the next slide, if we were to take the reductions that will be required as a result of the governor's budget, it would be about 1.5 additional FTE reduced in every county in the state. Now, what we've done here is I've just simply gone through and said, okay, let's just arbitrarily, frankly, take an additional FTE out of every, one additional FTE out of every county, take the rest off of campus. So you can see what the impact will be as you look at that particular slide. Then if we look at 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10% below the governor's budget, for each 2% reduction in addition to the governor's budget, we would lose an additional approximately 4.5 FTE. So if you go down to 10% from the governor's budget, that would be an additional reduction of about 22.5 FTE. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see the next slide then identifies the number of FTE, faculty FTE, that we would reduce in extension at the governor's budget level minus an additional 10%.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
I have a question about those reductions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking back on page 17 and just noticing that in the reductions that have already taken place, there are cuts to nutrition programs.
Yes.
And given where Oregon ranks with hunger and
yes.
issues around nutrition, why are we cutting those positions, and would that situation be further exacerbated by the slide that you're, the information that you're showing us now?
Mm-hmm. Representative, Chair Morgan and Senator Gordley, the reason these positions are identified currently in the current reductions are simply because the way we took the reductions during this biennium was to take them where the vacancies occurred. We are currently going through a process to determine what the priorities will be and determine how, as we move into the next biennium, our reductions will be taken. But in order to balance the budget and get through this fiscal year, we simply took the reductions where they occurred, where the vacancies occurred. Okay, you make a very good point in that given the situation in Oregon with a high hunger rate, this doesn't make sense. I agree.
And I would just hope that as you're looking at those priorities that we would keep that at the top of the list.
Yes. The other thing that that does is, like I mentioned before, for every dollar that we take out of that program, we actually lose two because we're losing the federal match dollar that we can get through grants to go with that.
Certainly. Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Bates.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you. Just so I'm clear, you've got written down positions reduced. I assume that means actual people reduced.
It absolutely means actual people reduced.
You've had some trouble with this committee with that nomenclature sometimes.
Yes.
Okay.
Has there been a discussion of foregoing COLA or any other benefits with this group other than letting people go?
Yes, there's been a lot of consideration of a number of different budget management strategies. We did not provide any COLAs for this group in the last fiscal year. We did provide some merit increases that were available to them. We had significant discussions about whether we should rescind those merit increases. We've made a decision to not do that, since they were based on merit as opposed to across the board based on COLA. And in the next biennium, we don't anticipate providing any salary increases for this group of people.
Follow up, Madam Chair. If you were successful in your other funds, which I hope you are, would you be able to balance this out and hold on to these employees?
No.
You'd still lose them?
Yes. We will still lose them.
Because looking at the, Madam Chair,
follow up.
Because looking at your requested budget, and my figures may be wrong, and your other funds increase, you just about balance that out. But my figures may be wrong. The ones we have here may be outdated.
Representative Bates, the increases that we've incurred have been, frankly, so significant that even if we were able to get the real dollars back, the increases have been so significant. Let me just give you one example. For one of our health insurance benefit packages, and this is one that's at the federal level, we used to pay $200 per faculty member for their federal health insurance benefits. That has increased to $700 per faculty member. And so when you have those kinds of increases that you're absorbing, you know, just coming back to zero simply doesn't provide enough resource to make up the difference.
Madam Chair?
Follow up.
In the health, as an example, the health industry, are you prescribed from looking at other programs to get into or capping benefits or asking for a greater premium from the individual employee?
Representative Bates, as a part of the system of higher education, we can provide the benefit packages that are provided through the system. We have access to one additional set of benefits, which is a federal benefit package that we no longer provide. But up until the probably 2 or 3 years ago, we did have access and extension to federal benefit packages that the rest of the system was not able to provide. Outside of that, we participate in the benefit packages that are available through the system of higher education.
Follow up?
Are you prescribed from changing that? Are you prescribed from getting outside that system?
Representative Bates, as far as I know, we are. But I can certainly ask the question.
As an example, I would point out there are certain systems that have had 18% increases, certain systems have had 3 or 4% increases, but you may be prescribed from enrolling in those. I just ask you to look at that.
And if Mr. McGee, I think, could provide some additional clarification on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bates. OUS does participate in the public employee benefit package negotiation for benefits. I'm sorry, Phil McGee for the record from Department of Administrative Services. Representative Bates, OUS does participate in the PEB benefit package system, and this is an issue that we'll be discussing when Senate Bill 437 comes before you. Higher ed is looking for some opportunities to be able to offer their own benefit package. We'll be talking to you about what the significant increase that would result for the overall state cost for benefits for all of our employees.
And I think you're already aware, Representative Bates, of the discussion around the impact that it has on the larger PEB system to pull these folks out.
That'll be an interesting discussion.
Yes, it will be. Representative March, please bear in mind that we have yet to do the forest research.
Absolutely. This should be easy, or they can get back to me. And that's you talked about you're getting some federal funds, but you haven't delineated federal funds in your budget pie. So where does that occur, and how much federal funding are you getting?
The federal funding that we're getting, if you go back to page 14, it identifies the federal funding that we had at the beginning of the biennium, and essentially it's flat.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Please go. Oh, I'm sorry. It's under Mezzanine.
And I hope I'm not getting ahead of you a little bit, but I've got one question, I guess, maybe two statements. First question is, as I look at your slide here, and maybe it's the next slide, is that accurate that that's about a 40% reduction in FTE?
It is accurate, and we'll get to that next slide if you want. Do you want me to go there?
Well, then let me. That's fine. Okay. Just hold that then. Let me go to a couple other statements. Some of the agents that you've got for the different counties actually can drift over and work on issues in other counties, especially those agents that come out of the campus situation. And I want to make that clear so it doesn't look like they're totally focused in the county.
Yes, thank you.
Also, when we talked about the office, some of the counties had two stations, two
mm-hmm.
offices.
Mm-hmm.
Those offices are paid for generally by the counties. Is that not true? And then your department pays for the staff?
That is correct, Senator Messerly. We use our state and federal dollars to pay for the faculty members' salaries, and then the county dollars are used to pay for the office, the secretarial support staff, and the paper, phones, everything that it takes to run the office.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify that because some counties had two staffs did not necessarily mean that's borne by this budget. So.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Please proceed.
There are just two more slides that I'd like to go through to help you understand where we are. The next one Senator Messerly referred to, which is a summary of FTE. When we started out this biennium in 01, we had 254.36 FTE. Again, that's spread over about 375 people or so. During this biennium, we have reduced by 29.61 FTE to help us balance the budget. Because of the amount of reduction during this biennium that we took on both one-time funds and out of supplies and services, as we look to the next biennium, we're going to have to take those reductions on an ongoing basis in the next biennium. So at the governor's level, it's perhaps not identified very well here. It's the 7103 level. We would need to reduce our FTE by an additional 48.83 FTE. If we go to 10% reduction to the governor's level, we would have to reduce an additional 22.5 FTE. So we would at that level end up at 153.42 FTE for extension. So that's the FTE summary, and this is faculty FTE, that we will lose at the 10% reduction level. Now, one of the reasons that this is so high, which I believe is, Senator Messerly, what you were trying to get at, one of the reasons that this is high is because a huge, huge majority of our budget, over 90% of our budget, is on people. And so when over 90% of your budget is on people, when there's a reduction, it's a very real reduction in people. There isn't flexibility within the budget for projects to be able to take that reduction in other ways. So that's what's illustrated here. There's one additional slide that I'd like to get to, and that has to do with the process that we're going through in order to make these decisions. And Senator Gordley referred to this just a moment earlier. We are currently involved in a process to help us make final decisions about what kinds of reductions we will, or where the reductions will actually be. In March, we spent time with each one of the county extension staff chairs collecting information and data from their local constituents to try to determine what their priorities were locally. All of that information came to a central meeting that was held last week. We are currently involved now in working from this FTE, the 153.42 FTE level, to determine how those FTE will be assigned for extension throughout the state. The initial draft proposal for that will come out next week. We will have then a two-week period of time for our constituents and for our faculty and staff to respond to that. I expect to get a lot of response to that, and none of it will be good, but I expect to get a lot of response to that, and then after that point in time, we plan to make initial decisions. Now, those decisions obviously will be in flux simply because we don't know where we're going to end up in terms of a budget for the next biennium. But once we do know that, then we'll make final decisions. We'll make adjustments in the plan that we had developed up to that point. up to that point in time. So I understand that you are, as a committee, in a very, very difficult situation. You have very difficult decisions to make. I do want to make sure that you understand what it is you're getting for the dollar that you invest in the Extension Service. And if you look at some of the items on page 23, just in summary, those are what you're getting for your investment in this program. You're getting a significant economic return through agriculture and the natural resource-based industries, a $24 billion industry in Oregon. You're getting a greater realized human potential through the 4-H program and through some of our nutrition education programs. You are getting a return based on a significant return from volunteers that we have in our program that help deliver our education to citizens of Oregon. You're getting a leverage value with the dollars that you provide for us. And again, over a million Oregonians use Extension Service education across the state of Oregon. Oregon is experiencing some very tough times. I recognize that, and I recognize that you have tough decisions to make. Extension does produce a very real return in economic value, in helping children and youth be productive, and in helping some of our most vulnerable families have a chance for success. I thank you very much for spending the time to address this issue, and I wish you well in the decisions you have to make.
Thank you. Final questions or comments for Dean Hoglum?
Excellent presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make the point very well that what I was trying to point out is that a 40% reduction overall from the start of this last biennium is a very huge reduction compared to many other budgets we've seen.
That's right. I agree, Senator. And I think that you did do a very good job of laying out the challenges that you face before the committee, and I thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you, Representative.
I'll call forward now Dean Salwasser to talk to us about the college, or the Forest Research Lab, rather. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Hal Salwasser. I'm the Dean of the College of Forestry and the Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory. And I'm pleased to have this opportunity to discuss the Forest Research Laboratory's budget in the context of the entire College of Forestry enterprise.
Are you able to lift up?
Okay.
Excuse me, where do I find this chart?
You don't have that particular PowerPoint in front of you,
okay.
Representative Smith.
Just want to make sure that that's fine.
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith,
I just wanted to be accurate.
The information on these slides is drawn from this book, but it's formatted a little differently.
And just to give you a little bit of context, we have piles of paper back here, and so we quite often don't find the piece that we're supposed to be looking at.
Chair Morgan, we are working out of the book that has Oregon Forest Research Laboratory on the top of it.
Thank you very much.
The College of Forestry serves Oregon's Forest Cluster, which is the forest and forest-related firms, agencies, university, communities, lifestyles, and industries, all affiliated with forests. This is a $12.8 billion industry in the state. It's over half of the total natural resource industry in the state, and it supports over 2,000 different firms and 75,000 family wage jobs. And this is not counting the jobs and the firms that are involved in retail sale of wood products or home construction or remodeling. It is also a foundation for social community and philanthropic activities in many communities, including Portland Metro, where many of the large foundations were put in place by individuals who were involved in the forest products industry. The forest cluster also contributes to the more than $3 billion recreation and tourism industry in this state, which supports 91,000 plus jobs and more than 4,000 firms. Forests cover 45% of the land area of Oregon, most of which is managed by federal agencies, but a substantial amount is managed by 35,000 private owners. 6% is managed by states, tribes, and counties. These forests provide the cleanest water coming off of any land use in the state and maintain healthy fish and wildlife populations due to the Oregon Forest Protection Laws, which have been in place since 1971 and been periodically refined based on the science that's been developed by the Forest Research Laboratory. The College of Forestry employs 249 people who show up as 228 full-time equivalents. Some of them are less than full-time. This faculty that's funded by the Forest Research Lab appropriation is also the teaching and the extension faculty in the college, and typically an individual would be funded by two or three different sources in varying amounts depending upon their workload. We teach nearly 350 undergrads and about 133 graduate students, graduating 77 undergrads and 48 grads. Our faculty produced 336 peer-reviewed publications, at least that number, non-peer-reviewed publications, book chapters, books, and workshop presentations, and made over 48,000 extension contacts. State general funds that go into our programs come in three different ways. The Ed in General supports the 13.75 teaching FTEs, 12.7 research FTEs, and 20.3 extension FTEs that Dean Hoagland just talked about, 26 support service FTEs to go with this. That's 73 total out of the 228 in the college that are financed by state general funds. The Forest Research Lab has a broad array of emphases, and I just highlight a few for you here. One is to maintain globally competitive forest products enterprises through the work we do in productivity, yield enhancement, manufacturing, business management practices, and marketing. We have a heavy focus on sustainable forest yields to make sure that our forests stay healthy and can continue providing the many benefits that they provide. Innovative and efficient use of forest products in helping the manufacturing industries gain better utilization of the raw material, helping the harvesting, the loggers, make better utilization of the wood that they have available from the forests. Major emphasis on restoring salmon habitats and watershed health in support of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watershed, and in protecting Oregon's high-quality water sources, most of which flow from the forested lands. Making sure that science is available and used in developing policies for private, state, and federal forests so that those policies are prudent, scientifically sound, effective, and not overly excessive. And in the process of carrying out the research, we are educating the scientists for the future. The state general funds leverage significantly in the College of Forestry. The teaching investments from Ed in General leverage $2 million, 1 to 1.1. The FRL appropriation leverages $14.7 million. That's $5.70 in outside research money generated for every dollar of appropriation. And $2.5 million for extension, that's 1.16. That leverage adds up to financing supporting 155 FTEs. That's compared to the 73 that are supported by general funds. So you can see the college is on a very entrepreneurial enterprise mode already. And this is clear from the pie chart that's shown here. We have nearly half of our entire operating budget coming from grants and contracts. The three wedges at the lower left are the state appropriations, and together they comprise 25% of our annual operations. The remainder comes from a harvest tax that the forest products industry imposes on itself, gifts and endowments, revenues that we generate from activities on the college forest, federal formula funds, which are also part of the federal match, which we more than cover with our state appropriation, and fees that we return from outreach education programs, workshop registration, and that sort of thing. The Forest Research Lab, as a part of that, is even more funded by grants and contracts, 61%. The state appropriation is at 14, the harvest tax at 12, and you can see the other numbers there. Within the Forest Research Lab, grants and contracts, these are the major sources. Federal government dominates, obviously. That's Department of Agriculture, Interior. They're even involved in some of the research co-ops, that 12% wedge. National Science Foundation, NASA, and EPA. 75% or more federal sources for funding. The private sector is significantly involved in research co-ops, as are some federal and state agencies and other grants as well. I want to show you where the education funding comes from for one primary reason, and that is the amount of our education funding that comes from non-state sources. Our largest investment in educating students at the College of Forestry comes from revenues that we generate on the college forest. Next largest is the Ed and General State Appropriation, followed by tuition, and endowments and gifts are greatly involved in providing scholarships, fellowships, covering faculty salaries, and helping with some program activities. Our extended education program is largely funded by state Ed and General funds, but we are also fairly entrepreneurial there, and we have 24% coming back in from the conference registrations that we hold and 14% from grants, and you can see the federal formula funds. During fiscal years 2001 to 2003, we, as everyone else, took budget reductions over 10% from what we started fiscal 2001 with, and I apologize, the bottom line there should be revised FY0103 authority. The effect of these reductions resulted in an inability to fill vacant positions, which we carried through, about 2.5 extension forester, 2.8 teaching, and 4.3 FRL research scientists. We eliminated 9.5 support service positions. We began looking at fiscal years 2003-2005 with the OUS program request. At $5.9 million for the biennium for the research lab, which would have financed 17 scientist FTEs. That would have restored the 4.3 that were left unfilled from 2001-2003. The governor's proposal brought us down to $5.24 million, which would have had us carrying the 4.3 vacancies through the biennium. Where we are, looking at the reductions that are likely to be considered and stepping them down in 2% increments, and we assume that each 2% represents 0.6 FTE in the Forest Research Lab, we would go from 12.7 to start with and basically drop 0.6 FTE. So at the 10% reduction level, we would have 9.7 FTEs, which is a little more than half of what we started 2001 with, and a net decline of 7.3 FTEs in the Forest Research Lab. The significance of this is that these are the people whose foundation funding from the state appropriation are leveraging those $5.70 for every dollar of the state investment, so it has a significant ripple effect through our entire programs. To give you a look at what the extension forester implications would be, we have a similar ratcheting down, although the FTE per 2% is 0.5. There's just a difference in how much funding goes into each FTE in these two programs. And this would be a tremendous reduction of well over 50% in our extension forester programs at the 10% level. We are not sitting back. Just slicing and taking all of this. We have, as I mentioned earlier, we have had an enterprise approach to how the college has run its operations. And here's our plan. We will start by making the cuts that are necessary based on what state appropriations end up being when we find out what those are. Secondly, we are in the process of revising the management plans for the college forests, and we anticipate increasing the harvests. We have more than enough timber volume to do this, and we would use those funds to help support some of the reductions that we have to take in education, research, and extension. We have already redirected existing funds to emphasize investments in strategic initiatives for Oregon's economy, and the four priorities that we have identified there is fire and forest health, education, research, and outreach, which, as you all know, is critical to Southwest, Central, and Eastern Oregon. An investment in forest yield and value research and outreach, which is critical to the ability of our private sector forests to maintain their global competitive advantage and do that in a way that maintains the high-quality environment that goes along with their management. The third is building a strong scientific foundation for the water, fish, and forest and water and fish and forest protection laws. This is a paired watershed study that's currently going on in southwest Oregon. And last, an investment in innovations in wood products through research and outreach. And we believe these investments have great potential to leverage additional outside resources in grants and contracts and research co-ops. Fourth, we're working with the Oregon State University Foundation to increase private giving, which currently finances four fully endowed faculty chairs and two professorships, and we are working on several more. We're working on major endowments for scholarships and programs. And fifth, we will work actively and energetically with the Oregon State University Strategic Plan, or OSU 2007, to improve program delivery, looking at working more effectively with the College of Agricultural Sciences and several other units on campus to get efficiencies in delivering our degree and research and outreach programs, reducing our business costs, and increasing grants and contracts for research. I won't bother you with what we would do with 2 or 4% additions to the budget. I would be happy to take any questions you might have at this time.
Representative Smith.
Would you talk to me a minute about your strategies for harvesting your forests?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith. The college forests have a primary objective of teaching, research, and demonstration, and they have secondarily an opportunity to generate revenues. We have 14,500 acres in college forests in seven different locations in the state. And because the emphasis historically has been on the teaching and research, we have had a very conservative approach to harvest, and we have recently been harvesting only a third of the annual growth. We have significant standing volume, and our college plan gives us the opportunity to increase the harvest perhaps 50 to 75%. We can do that for the next 2 years with a couple of major assumptions. One is that we can do that in a way that does not alienate neighbors. We know we can do it within forest protection laws. One of our uncertainties is the value of the wood that's harvested has been going down recently, and we're not sure we can get the exact value out of the trees harvested that we could. But our strategy is to increase harvest on the property closest to campus this year, and then to go up to the Blodgett property, which is in the northwest part of the state, and carry out the harvest there in the next year. And by that time, we should have our management plans revised, and we will know whether that strategy can be sustained into the future or perhaps increased.
So on your current forest harvest practices, aside from your accelerated, if you were to continue on your current forest practices and your logging, is that would be sustainable over the life of the forest as far as yield is concerned?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, the current rate of harvest would be sustainable with much room to spare. We would actually be accumulating wood biomass on the forest every year, eventually to a point where it would create some problems with forest health and fire hazards.
Mm-hmm. So after you get over this two-year bump that you have, you've increased your acceleration by 50%, and I'm assuming that you'll go back and look at maybe you could increase your thinning levels to a point where it would not affect your overall growth potential is what I mean.
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, our projections are that we can actually increase growth by thinning the forest in many places and by making investments in the reforestation that take advantage of technologies that we now have.
Representative Rich.
Thank you. What this is an interesting line. Your increase in harvest, what should that produce ballpark over the next 2 years? And then secondly, you mentioned in here reserve funds. What's the total amount of your reserve funds at this point?
Chair Morgan, Representative March, our reserve funds were fairly substantial at the start of fiscal year 2001. At the end of this fiscal year, they would be down to about zero. They were a combination of carryovers plus some revenue that had been generated from the college forests that we had not invested. There was some working capital in the Oregon State University Foundation that we had not obligated. We plan by the end of this fiscal year to have used up all of the reserves, to have obligated all but about $800,000 in the foundation, which would be used in fiscal 2004. And we will have used up all of the reserve, the net revenues that are not necessary for contingencies in college forest management by the end of 2005 under the governor's budget. At the 10% reduction level, we will use that all up in fiscal year 2004. Therefore, our strategy for increasing revenues by increasing harvest now and being more aggressive in grants and contracts so we don't hit the wall literally.
How much did you expect from the timber? I didn't.
This is a difficult thing to project. Our harvest, the volume harvested can definitely go up from what we're doing now by about 50% without significant increased costs. So the net return on our management investment is actually higher for the additional harvest than it is for the first part. The big uncertainty is the value of the stumpage. We were anticipating several months ago that we could get perhaps $1,900,000 in net revenue, where we currently were drawing $1,100,000. But a $100-$150 reduction in stumpage could cut that in half very easily. So there's a big uncertainty with regard to how effective the part of our strategy that deals with revenues from the college forest can be.
Further questions, Mr. Bender?
Were those annual figures you were giving or biannual?
Chair Morgan, Mr. Bender, yes, those were annual figures.
Further questions or comments for Dr. Salwasser? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that concludes our presentation on what we call the state rights. And I think that we did get a very good body of information and made it real clear what our deliberations are going to look like in these areas. And having no further input from the committee, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5021, and I will adjourn this meeting, and we'll reconvene on Monday at 8:30 for public testimony on the higher education budget.